Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Today, we're going to be picking up with our old mate, Dr. Noev Kashyap, and we're going to be continuing to part two of our series around the stages of practice growth. We spoke last week about the need to get things started correctly if you're starting a practice from scratch. We went through a couple of those key elements like location and marketing and a few other things that need to be absolutely spot on for your practice to start right. And we spoke about it in the context of the stages of practice growth because if you get those foundations in place to begin with, you can progress through those stages of growth quickly. But equally, if you don't get that right, then the chances of progressing through those stages of growth diminish rapidly. So there's a lot of good information in that last episode. And if you're thinking about starting a practice or you're about to, I'd really encourage you to go back and listen to it. There's a lot of gold that Noev gives out in that particular episode. In today's episode, what we're going to be doing is picking up that thread and we're going to be thinking about how to move from that startup or that survival phase into a more stable phase where you've got, you know, regular cash flow and what needs to be done to get there as quickly as possible. So we're assuming that you've started up well and we're going to be dissecting out a couple of the key things that need to happen to get to that next level of stability. So typically, a couple of things you'll be wanting to think about is making sure there's some budgeting and other things. We're going to be covering how to do a budget. We're going to be talking about some of the systems that need to be in place. We're going to be talking about a bit more about HR. We're going to be talking a bit more about some of the processes and protocols. And we cover a lot of ground. I'm going to be sharing with you some of my mistakes. Noev's going to be sharing with you some of the things that he's done really well, some of the things he might do differently. And we're going to be, I guess, interrogating one another. We're going to be going back and forth. Noev's going to ask me some questions. I'm going to ask him some questions. So hopefully in this particular conversation, you'll get the best of both worlds. So without any further ado, here it is, the episode on the stages of practice of growth, moving from survival through to stability. I hope you enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. In this series, I'm talking with Dr. Noev Kashyap, and we're going through the five stages of growth of a dental practice. And last week, we went through a really in-depth analysis of some of the key factors that need to be taken into account as you start a practice. Because if you don't start right, then the opportunity to progress through those subsequent stages becomes really impossible in many cases, or certainly much more difficult. And you might remember that the five stages of practice growth are really when you start off at survival, and then you move through stability, success, scaling, and then, of course, starting on. So we're going to talk today a lot about how to move through that survival phase, get through the startup material, and then get to stability as quickly as possible. And when it comes to stability, what I'm talking about there is when you've got an EBITDA or you're pulling out of the practice somewhere up to about 400, 450, even 500K. And we're going to be going through the things that you need to have in place to make sure that process happens as quickly and as smoothly as possible. So, Noev, welcome back. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Jesse. Had a good weekend. Yeah, everything's good. How about yourself?
Yeah, tops, mate. Really good weekend as well. And it's actually starting to get, dare I say, it's winter in Canberra. So I'm going to use the word warm very loosely, but because Canberra and winter are usually not warm, but we've had a lovely weekend down here, mate. So everything's cool.
I actually had the aircon on for a little bit on, I think it was either Saturday or Sunday. I forget which day. Part of that was probably some of my natural insulation as well that played a role there. But
now you're just making me jealous of the warm weather, mate. That's
I know. It was quite pleasant actually up here.
Oh, good, good. So, mate, we're going to be going through a whole lot of stuff around stability, and we're going to be going back and forth because, ladies and gents, what Noev and I are planning to do with this particular episode is we're going to be interrogating one another. So we see our roles as trying to extract the best out of both of our brains and present it to you guys, hopefully in a coherent manner so that you can take the information and make it your own and apply it to your practice. So, Noev, as you move from survival in your practices and you've gone through that startup phase, what have been the key things that have helped you get through that to having a more mature practice, one that's more stable? What have been the key things there?
Look, I think Jesse, once you start to move through the stages, so we talked about survival last time, and yeah, that was roughly the way that you define it as an EBITDA or a profit, you know, just for ease of terms, of less than 150,000. So from the startup phase to about 150,000, I think the key drivers of that are really good cash flow.
Yep.
So once your patient flow starts, that backs up some really good cash flow. You start to get, you know, 150,000 EBITDA is doing quite well. And then moving through the stages onto the next level, I think, just a concentration on cash flow, starting to look at expenses and everything like that. And I think from that point on, it becomes, if we can get this stage right, moving through the subsequent stages becomes a lot easier as well. But I guess, you know, my expertise, Jesse, lies primarily in the first bit, getting it up to this stage. And while I obviously still am okay at growing the practices from that point, I think the more important question is what do you feel are the I guess three most important things to lay down, main foundations to lay down at this point to ensure that we can move through these stages quicker?
Yeah, cool. Well, I think you've already hit the biggest one, and that is managing cash. And I think when we spoke last week, we made the observation that, you know, cash flow and management of it is absolutely critical. Pretty much in every stage of the business, actually, but you know, cash flow is like oxygen, and without it, your practice tends to wither. So for me, one of the first things, or the first thing that I get, I think all my clients do, I can't think of a single client we haven't done this with, is to really put together a robust cash flow forecast. And it's a budgeting process. It's a 12-month process, and we then break that down month by month, quarter by quarter. So it really acts as a roadmap. And the purpose of that budget or that forecast is really to really not just be so, you know, out of the ballpark. Yes, so I've gone from 150 EBITDA or profit, and you know, next year I'm going to go to a million. We want it to be manageable. We want it to be realistic, but we do want it to be a bit of a stretch as well, because we want to keep working towards higher goals, higher and higher goals. And we know that if we can put that stretch in there, then you're more likely to hit it, as opposed to just kind of putting something that's totally out of the ballpark in that first year in there. So we do map that out. So that's the first thing.
Yeah, just so I can understand that properly, when we're talking about cash flow in the context that you're talking about, do you look at it from a revenue point of view, or do you look at it from a profit point of view? So when you're creating these forecasts, you're obviously forecasting revenue. That's a given. But do you then also forecast the expenses based on that revenue, or how do you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, when you're in that startup phase, sometimes forecasting expenses can be a little bit of a dark art, of course, because you might not have the trading history to go with. So when I was doing some formal business study, one of the forecasting methods that we learned through that process, and there was a whole variety of them, but one of the forecasting methods was basically a thing quite literally called naive forecasting. And what that involves is looking at historic data and making a subjective assessment as what you expect to happen, you know, in the upcoming period. And one of the comments that I remember coming through that whole process was, there's all these fancy forecasting methods, but most people still default to naive forecasting, which is kind of weird. So coming, the exact process that I would follow in terms of putting financial forecasts together for my own practice, and in fact, it's what I've just done a couple of weeks ago, because we've gone through the end of financial year, we're now into this one, is the first thing I did was I looked at what I personally needed to draw from the practice. What was the profit I wanted to make from the practice? And so we did that through, you know, if you're at home and you're doing this, you might want to look at your lifestyle expenditure. What do you need to live on, basically? And what sort of savings do you need to have? What tax do you need to allow for? So on and so forth. So,
okay, so you're talking about personal expenses at this point in time.
At this point in time, I'm talking about personal expenses. Now, remembering that this cash flow forecast is not a taxation document. It's not something that your accountant's going to, you know, necessarily use to do your books with. So for me, I lump some things that effectively go through the business, like my car and all that sort of stuff. I still lump them in as personal expenses, because I need to still draw the money from the practice to cover the. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, no, definitely. This is an interesting learning for me, Jesse, because for myself, you know, I've never brought my personal expenses into it. So, you know, I can see exactly how, you know, for a person that started their first practice and they're, you know, moving ahead with that, that can really be quite helpful to be able to incorporate that into your cash flow forecast. So, you know, you're basically, from the gist of what I'm getting, is you're basically looking at, you know, what you need to live on, and also have a lifestyle that you want to enjoy, and then you're going to try to back that up with some revenue from the practice.
Completely. And so that's exactly what we're going to do. So what we do is we look at the lifestyle requirements that we have. We look at the expenditure that's going to be required to operate the practice. We effectively add those two numbers together, and we end up with a total revenue target for the practice. Then what happens is we look at the net contribution of associates or therapists, hygienists, or whomever else you might have at the practice working for you. And then the balance, the outstanding balance, falls to the principal to earn. And then ultimately, what will happen from there is you look at your calendar and you figure out how many days per year that you're going to be working. And you take that, you know, revenue target for the principal dentist, and you divide that by the number of days that you're working. And that gives you a daily target. And so that's, you know, really as complicated as it needs to be. But the main challenge with doing this is making sure you forecast accurately. You do look at all the expenses in your practice, and even there's a lot of little things that get paid for. So, you know, if you've got historic data to refer back to, that's really, really important. But if you're still new in practice, then you're going to have to make your best assessment at this particular moment in time. And I can always tell you that your first forecast is your least accurate, because you just don't have the data to refer back to.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the major things that happen in this stage is because you start to grow a little bit more, you can even be really quite conservative in your favor. So what I mean by that is, you know, like a lot of your expenses are fixed costs in that survival stage, but at the stability stage, when we get as we move through the stages of growth, you start to get a lot of your expenses or your fixed expenses already paid for. So you're actually forecasting favorably if you're using historic data, because, you know, your fixed expenses are quite paid for. So yeah, no, that's an interesting way of looking at it. So look, moving from there, you basically establish this forecast, you establish this daily goal for the principal. Do you talk to the associates about any of their daily targets or goals that are needed?
Yeah, so we have a really, as part of the forecasting process, I have a robust discussion with all the clinicians in the practice, and we talk about, you know, we look at the historic data and we look at what they've earned, and we also put in, you know, some room for growth in that. And then we look at obviously making sure it's reasonable, making sure people can work within their scope of practice, all those other sorts of things. And that's particularly relevant if you've got therapists or hygienists or whatever. But ultimately, yes, everyone is aware of their daily goal within the practice. The whole practice is aware of everyone's daily goal. And in fact, all our systems are then geared up to bring that daily goal to life.
Okay, so can you talk a little bit about some examples of the systems that you've got in place to achieve the, you know, whatever the daily revenue target is?
So, you know, if we do have quite a few systems which are all geared up to make sure that the daily revenue target comes to life. And the first one, and probably the most critical one, is the appointment book. Our appointment book is structured in such a way that we make sure we leave certain amount of space in the appointment book for productive procedures, you know, whether it's endo, crown and bridge, you know, wisdom teeth, whatever. And we know that, you know, we look to try and achieve 80% of our daily goal through those productive procedures. It's the 80-20 rule, it's the Pareto principle. And we know that, you know, 20% of our procedures produce 80% of our revenue. And by and large, that holds true. And the other way of doing it, of course, is, you know, for whatever reason, if those procedures don't come through the door, we then use the, you know, the hourly rate or schedule to a daily goal. And we try and make sure that we're getting as close to that every single time. When it comes to other systems around bringing that budget to life, we're also really conscious of the internal communication within the practice. And so, like lots of practices, I'm sure, who are familiar with the morning huddle, we run a morning huddle as well. But a huge focus of our morning huddle is making sure that the practice meets its financial targets for the day. So everyone's really aware of it. We know what we did yesterday. We know whether we're up or down on a day-by-day, month-by-month basis. And we know what we're all doing around that. So those are a couple of the big things that we do to make sure that the revenue comes in as well. And I guess on top of that too, when you think about revenue, just to quickly add some more into it, there's really only three ways to increase revenue when you think about it. And the three ways to increase revenue in any business, and dentistry is no exception, is one is to see more patients. And that, of course, comes down to making sure you've got full books, you've got good marketing, your recall system's going strongly, all that sort of stuff. The second way to, you know, increase revenue is to increase the average dollar spend. And that comes down to making sure you've got a complete scope of services. So you're looking at those clinical skills and, you know, making sure that you can keep as much in-house as possible. And it also comes down to case acceptance, of course, as well, which we're going to discuss in another episode. And the third way of increasing revenue is to see patients more frequently. And that, of course, makes ensures making sure you have a really tight recall system. So when we're thinking about making sure our daily targets are met, we're obviously thinking about what's happening on a given day, but we have to make sure that all those other things are happening at the same time. So that's what we focus on a lot when it comes to revenue, mate.
Yeah, look, that's really interesting insight, Jesse. I think listeners are going to benefit a lot from everything that you've spoken about. So, you know, the fact that you link it all back to what you do on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, here you are basically forecasting like in the long term, so over a year, but you link that back to what you can practically do every day. And I think there's some great lessons there to be learned for all practice owners. Now, so you've mentioned cash flow forecasts and you touched a little bit on the internal communication. What other things do you think have contributed to your client's success and your own success, obviously, in moving through these stages, you know, from when you've gone from survival to stability?
I think one of the key things around, well, touching on communication, internal communication as well, is having everyone invested in the outcome. And so going a little bit predating, I suppose, the internal communication piece, one of the things I was very clear about was what we were trying to create at the very beginning. So I created a vision in my own mind about what I wanted the practice to look like. And of course, I then communicated that to the team. And everything that we're doing in terms of, you know, communicating and all the rest of it all comes back to, you know, what are we trying to create? What's our purpose here? What is it we're trying to do on a given day? And so all the systems that we have, you know, the morning huddle I've just spoken about where, you know, that's the short, sharp 10-minute meeting, which is, you know, brief. It's like a briefing of, you know, imagine President Obama's going to a meeting with a group of advisors. Well, he gets, you know, people talking in his ear just before he goes into the meeting and, you know, briefs him about who he's about to speak to. Well, our huddle is very short and sharp like that as well. But the other system that's been really useful for us is to have regular staff meetings. And you'd be surprised, the most dentists I know see a staff meeting or even a morning huddle as lost revenue because it's not time that they're actually seeing patients. But in my experience, when you've got the whole team rowing together in the same direction and in the same time, that lost time, in inverted commas, comes back, you know, a gazillion times over in terms of increased productivity, increased team cohesion, increased training, performance of the team, and so on. So that's been massive for us because one of the things that I've found is having a really effective and high-functioning team has been pivotal. You know, you can't do it all yourself. And if you've got a great team to support you, then that's obviously key. And having a staff meeting to share ideas, train, do those other things has been really helpful. And the other system that's been, again, really, really useful in my particular case has been to make sure I allocate time in my own book to think. And it sounds like a funny thing to say, but, you know, we get so busy with our hands in people's mouths and doing the day-to-day stuff that we often take the thinking time as for granted and we try and fit it in here and there. But I've actually structured some critical thinking time into my diary and I template my time outside of the clinic as much as I do in the clinic so that I know that on any given day, you know, I want to spend a couple of hours thinking about strategic direction of the practice or what other things I'm doing. And that's been really helpful as well, just to give myself that, you know, clear thinking time.
Excellent. No, that makes a lot of sense, Jesse. And just to add, I guess, to that, recently, you know, we had that training course with you, with all our staff a few months ago now. But ever since that, we implemented regular staff meetings. You know, we used to have staff meetings as a haphazard kind of thing. But one of the big key takeaways we got out of that, the 2-day training seminar with yourself, and this is the staff, you know, they came to us and basically requested that we have regular staff meetings. And that's been excellent. We've had two now. So we do them roughly 4 to 6 weeks apart. And the agenda's created. So we actually made a staff meeting committee. So there's one dentist, one DA, one receptionist that form that meeting committee. And all our practices basically send through agenda items. Anyone can send through an agenda item
Great.
To one of the meeting coordinators. They veto it. And, you know, they might discuss something with me in regards to those agenda items, gets placed on the agenda. We start off the meeting discussing the previous meeting and the agenda items that arose or the action items that arose out of that meeting and whether that's been met. And then we progress to the current meeting's agenda. And then we create action items that need to be done. And look, it allows really robust discussion. One thing that you touched on, you know, or you touched on quite a few things that the meeting creates, but one of the other things that we found is where there are systems lacking, or where there are systems that could be improved, I should say, having the robust discussion amongst dentists, DAs, and receptionists all in one forum allows them to be not just held accountable, but allows them to create the system themselves. So it's not something that's been imposed upon them. They basically decided this. This is what they all agreed with. And, you know, that people, if someone creates an idea, they're more likely to follow it than having an idea shoved down their throat. And that's one thing that these, you know, I alluded to the fact that my HR systems probably haven't been the best previously. And, you know, it's just such a simple thing that's just led to a massive culture shift in our practices. And, you know, the staff are a lot more engaged. They're starting to see that their opinions and their suggestions are valued and they're being implemented. And, you know, stuff like this where it was basically myself and some practice managers that would make decisions. Now that we've given that back to even the most junior staff member, you can see the whole team is empowered instead of just myself and my practice managers, which, you know, is excellent. And I think a new practice having that in place much earlier on than what I did, you know, I can only imagine the success that they could come to see.
Yeah. And no, just pulling you on that, because one of the things I'm really curious to dive down into your staff meetings, because, ladies and gents, for the audience there are many ways to be right, okay? So what we want to try and do here is present some options for you that you can take and make your own. But Nov, one of the things I'm curious to know is, as you've gone through your staff meetings and you've laid out the action items and you've checked in about the progress against those action items, I'm guessing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that once you've actually begun the process of ticking off action items, does that create a positive energy in the meetings as well? And do people kind of feel like, well, we're actually getting through some stuff?
Oh, definitely. And especially if you spread around those action items. You know, we have junior staff that have to work on an action item. We have, you know, senior staff and staff in between that have to work on different action items. You know, one of the issues we were having was DAs not being in the room when the dentist was ready to begin because, you know, they might be off to just do a bit of steri or something like that. And a simple thing was just going to get some electronic bells, the bell is right next to the door, and then it connects to the actual speaker that's in the stereo room. So, you know, the dentist just subtly touches the bell. It sends a little audible sound there. And, you know, our DA, Brooke, went and bought those from Bunnings, installed them all herself. And, you know, it was done in a really, really timely manner. And yeah, just empowering the staff to be able to do that and help out with things like that has just been, you know, really good. They do definitely feel a lot more engaged in answer to your question. And as they tick off those action items, it basically, yeah, it does create a positive energy. And the other thing is they don't seem to procrastinate on it. It seems to be done almost in the week after the meeting. And one of the other great things is, you know, we've had a staff member that's only recently started with us, and there was a particular system that we wanted to tighten up a little bit in reception, and it was around lab work. And we had some really robust discussion at the meeting that created what we felt was a good system, but some of the minor details of the system could possibly have been better. And she just came up with an amazing way to deal with those minor details in the days subsequent to the meeting, sent that to all the staff. And, you know, this is a staff member that wasn't even with us 5-6 months ago. So, and, you know, it's now going to be implemented across all my practices. So, you know, that's an idea of just what the meetings sort of bring to the table. And, you know, I know there's a lot of dentists out there. I've never been a control freak. I've never been a dentist that had any trouble delegating, but
which, by the way, I think has been a huge contributor to your success.
Yeah. But, you know, we've never had the level of engagement with staff. It's always just been amongst my practice managers. You know, it's kind of been a little bit dictatorish, I guess, amongst our management group. But, yeah, no, moving that back onto all the staff has been a great success. One thing you touched on, Jesse, that I wanted to talk a little bit about was the time for critical thinking. And I think one of the major things that people can take away from that are around this delegation that I was talking about. Now, there's too many dentists out there, and this is a statement more than a question, but there's a lot of my clients and dentists I talk to generally do so much of the stuff that they can delegate easily.
Completely.
Yeah, to their receptionist or their head of reception, their practice managers, or even their junior staff. And that basically leaves them zero time for the critical thinking, the thing that they can't actually delegate to their junior staff. And it just seems so backward and obvious to me that that can't happen, you know. And it's a mistake, and you know, I'm being very judgmental in saying this, but you know, I really think that as a business owner, you know, if you're not doing some critical strategic thinking around your business, then really, you know, you need to take a good long hard look at yourself, because you know, and the main reason is not that they're not capable, the dentists aren't capable of that, it's because they've spent so much time, you know, doing the ordering or doing the staff pays themselves,
or, you know, bookkeeping. Whatever.
Yeah, menial task can be done by someone else that they just don't have the time to then spend on this, because, you know, they've got their family to spend time with, they've got all of that. So, look, that's a really key thing that I guess both of us have done, yourself and me, along the way, and I think that's contributed a lot.
Yeah, and one of my mentors said to me really early on in my working life, actually it might have even been before I finished dentistry, I can't remember, and that was never get good at the little things. Because if you find yourself taking on all these crappy little jobs, then you find yourself doing them forever and ever and ever. And while I know what goes on in my practice, you know, with a fair degree of detail, if you said to me, do you know how to enter an invoice into Xero? I wouldn't have the foggiest. I've got no idea how to do that. And you know what? I don't really want to know.
Yeah.
I want to know that my books are up to date, and I want to know that they're accurate and all that sort of stuff, but do I need to be the person to do it? Absolutely not. And so I agree with you, Nova. I find that there's a lot of dentists paying what I call dumb tax. And dumb tax is when you're spending your time doing things that you should not be doing. It's just, it's a complete waste of resource.
No, it's a good point, Jesse. So, you know, we've covered off on cash flow, and you've talked a bit about that. We've talked a bit about our internal communication and HR systems. What other things do you think could help drive the ship in this stage?
I think one of the things that to get through to that stability phase really quickly is, again, coming back to team and utilizing the team, you know, basically understanding how to build a team, onboard a team, train a team, and ultimately retain a team as well. So I think, you know, taking a systematic approach to your HR, and obviously that's something you're in the process of doing as well. But, you know, it's long been my belief that success of any kind is really a team sport, and business is definitely a team sport. So I think it's in everyone's interest to try and attract the best possible players to their team, the best possible staff members. And so we have a 10-point recruitment checklist, which I go through, and it's very simple. You know, we start off making sure everyone's got a clear role description, a position description. We look at our org chart. Where does this, you know, particular position fit into the structure of the business? Has the position been budgeted for? Can we afford it? We go through creating, placing ads. We sort and vet applications. And we prepare interview questions. And we do skills tests in our interviews as well. Nov, do you guys do that at all?
No, we haven't. We have started to do that now, but we haven't. Well, sorry, I shouldn't say that. We're basically starting the implementation of the skills test at the interview. A lot of my senior staff have now done them themselves.
Yeah, nice.
We're going to move to doing that with the junior staff, so the senior staff can understand all of the staff. But yeah, the next stage will be incorporating that into the interview process of new staff.
Yeah. So once we've done the initial interview, we obviously go and do our due diligence, and then we look at, you know, how we're going to make a formal offer. And you know, you and I have had plenty of conversations privately about, you know, contracts versus enterprise agreements and which works and, you know, which is the best way forward, and then ultimately making sure we onboard and train our staff. So we've taken, I guess the point I'm trying to make by going through that, you know, those 10 points really quickly, is to highlight the fact that it's done systematically, that it's not just, you know, come on into the practice, welcome to the deep end. We try very hard to be as systematic and as methodical in our approach. And of course, there are some things that happen, you know, out of the blue that knock us off kilter. I think the other day I shared a Facebook Live video about this virus we had, and that took us off course for the day. But our new receptionist handled it pretty well, and we got there. But so certainly taking a systematic approach to HR, I think, has been a key thing for us, mate.
Yeah, no, that's excellent insight, Jesse. Now, one of the things that comes up on the forums a lot, particularly on the owners forum, is your enterprise bargaining agreement. You seem to be fairly unique in the world of dentists in terms of having an enterprise bargaining agreement that's been ratified by an employment lawyer. Can you go into that a little bit? Like, what firstly caused you to even think about an EBA versus just a normal staff contract that most of us have?
Well, it had its origins probably a decade ago. And when we had our first practice here in Canberra, we had a particular staff member who was, she was in a reception role, and she left the practice under what we thought were pretty amicable terms. But some 2 months later, we received a letter from her feeling or indicating that she felt that we hadn't paid all her entitlements. And of course, we felt that we had, and we could go through our records and did the calculations, and we thought we had. Anyway, accompanying her letter was a threat, basically saying that if we didn't pay her this particular amount of money, she was going to report us to, as it was known then, the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, which is Fair Work today. And so ultimately, we called her bluff, and she did report us to the department. And anyway, it was all investigated, and we were found to have done the right thing. In fact, we'd probably overpaid her a little bit, but that's a whole nother situation. But out of that process, even though we were right, it was massively stressful, and I wouldn't want to go through it again. But what came out of that was, at that particular time, there was no real awards for dental assistants. There was no awards for hygienists. And we were basically operating off a clerk's award of some description, I think from memory at the time. But I couldn't keep track of what awards I was meant to be following. I couldn't keep track of what the updates were, what the entitlements were, and what my compliance issues were. So after we had successfully defended that particular claim, I said to my lawyer at the time, look, I just want a single document. I want a document that serves as a reference document so that we can have everyone on the same page at the same time, and I know where I stand, the staff know where they stand, and if there's ever any doubt, we go back to what I call the Bible and go, all right, what does the document say? And that's our guiding document. And at that particular time, I think it was called it wasn't called an enterprise agreement, it was called something else, a certified agreement. And so we had a certified agreement back in the day, and it outlined job descriptions, job categories, I should say, some particular quirks around each of those categories, but it then outlined all the rights and obligations of all the parties associated with the document, so myself, the staff, and so on as well. And when we got our second practice, I had that system in the first one. I loved it so much, so I just wanted that simplicity. So we got another one drawn up. It was all ratified by Fair Work. There's a process to go through there. But for me now, when I employ someone, I literally give them a one-page letter, not even, it's like a table on that says, you know, dear, you know, so-and-so, we're pleased to be able to offer you the position of dental assistant level 2 at Bespoke Dental. Your terms and conditions are outlined in the attached enterprise agreement. Your rate of pay is X dollars either per week, per month, per annum, or per hour, depending on the type of employment structure we have. And you'll be either, you know, full-time, part-time, or casual according to the document. And it's great. And so there's a couple of other things that we had inserted into that agreement. And I'm just mindful of how this comes across on the thing. But we had a situation where in Canberra, we're paying really high wages. And so our overtime bill was killing us a little bit. And again, yeah, I felt that I wanted to make sure I paid my staff really well, but I just got sick of counting the minutes on the clock. You know, I've signed off at 5:06 and 37 seconds. It felt like some of the staff at the first practice were doing. And so I just kind of have always been a you scratch my back, I scratch your back kind of guy. And so we took the view that if we pay our staff well, we had a clause in the enterprise agreement that basically said that anything we pay in excess of the minimum entitlements, we can use to offset other entitlements, notably overtime. So again, it was for budgeting certainty for me. So I knew very carefully, or very clearly at the beginning of each year, what my wages bill was going to be. I can predict it. And so that, again, coming back to the first point we made earlier about cash flow forecasting, if you've got certainty around your expenditure, then that makes it much, much easier to forecast. And one of the biggest things that was, you know, causing a few fluctuations in my forecast was wages. So that was where it all came back from.
Definitely. And that, I mean, that makes sense, because wages are probably the highest cost of doing business in a dental sense. So yeah, no, that's great insight again, Jesse. Now, in terms of Yeah, just going back a step, for myself, you've obviously systemized HR and we're in the process of systemizing HR, but just a bit of an anecdote from my own experience. Yeah. You know, I've had issues with junior staff turnover for a long, long time. Senior staff and staff that have been with me for a long time, or sorry, I should say senior staff in terms of management level staff, we don't seem to have as high turnover. And the reason for that is because a lot of them get access to me much more frequently. They yeah. understand the culture and the vision that I've got for the practice. And, you know, the mistake was that wasn't written down. That was never shown to everyone. That was always just from myself to my practice managers. But, you know, from them down, it kind of was a lost connection. So anyway, we had this really bad problem of staff turnover. And one day it hit me when we lost a really, really good staff member because of problems we were having with bad staff members that yeah. were just, you know, we just kept them around for a bit too long. And that day I just sort of sat back and I thought, okay, what can I do? And, you know, this is, again, I should have got help on this earlier. But the way that I kind of got around it was I looked at all my staff members and I looked at all the best staff members and I thought, okay, well, how did we recruit them? And what I actually found, you know, we have, I think we've got about 30, 40 auxiliary staff. But what we found was the best staff members were actually referred by other staff members that were already working for us.
Cool.
So what I thought, okay, well, there's something there. So what I did, I took something that's an emotional or somewhat of a, you know, I guess a psychological thing and got that back to a logical process. And so I just simply went to the staff and said, look, if you recommend a staff member to us that stays with us for longer than 6 months, we will pay you $500.
Nice.
You know, and when you look at how much I pay for Seek advertising or other recruitment sources, the time taken to train bad staff and then, you know, get rid of them and the headaches associated
and the lost
with that.
Productivity, yeah.
Exactly right. All of that. It just, you know, the last 7 staff members we have hired have been recommendations from other staff members. And each of those 7 would rank amongst the top staff members I've ever had of all time. So what I actually found and the conclusion that I came to was that basically my staff, my senior most staff, and look, we don't take referrals from all our staff members. They have to be, you know, staff members that we consider to be really good, which is what our team has kind of gotten to now. But what I found is they understood inherently what was important, the skills that were important, the attitudes more importantly, which were important to our practice. And they knew amongst their own friend or peer group who those people were. So here they were outsourcing all the skills test. I was kind of outsourcing all that stuff to my existing staff because they had been working with me and they knew what was expected. They were getting these staff members in. So, you know, that was great for me. That was awesome. But look, there's a limit to that. You know, there's a limit to how many people different people know. So when I sat down with a HR specialist and I kind of explained what I had done to her, she basically came up with a thing for me that said, look, Nov, we can actually interview for that. So I can interview your staff, I can talk to them, I can see what makes them tick, and we can get the skills and the attitudes that you need. And then I can formulate interview questions around that for you to basically, so you know, your pool of available great staff is going to be infinite, not just the people that know the existing employees of yours. So, you know, that was great insight for me to be able to see, you know, for HR for me has always been one of the dark arts. It's something that's, you know, I've always considered a bit airy-fairy, you know, there's not a lot of thought to it. It just, and you know, wrongly so, but it's been great, you know, since we've got some of these steps in place. But I think the other important thing is, though, for the audience, would be for you to perhaps talk a little bit about your recruitment process in terms of, you know, a bit more depth of how you hire, what you look for, you know, let's pick a specific position. When you're looking for a DA that is going to be working with a senior associate for the bulk part of, you know, her working time, you know, do you hire that straight out? Do you hire a junior DA? How do you make that decision? Let's say a DA with 5 years of experience has decided she's going to move to Sydney and you need to replace her. How would that go in your organization?
Okay, cool. A couple of things I will just say before I go and dive into that. I have made just about every recruiting mistake under the sun. And so a lot of the stuff that I'm sharing with you has been born out of necessity and frustration with my own failure. And just as a quick segue, one of the biggest mistakes I've always made with my staff, my nature is always to be friendly and casual. And my probably the mistake I make time and again, even today, and I'm aware of it, is becoming too friendly too soon. So just a short little segue there. But anyway, one of the things that I think, you know, if I was recruiting someone now, the first thing we do is we look very clearly at the position description to start with. Is it still relevant? Is it still up to date? Does it still serve us? We know we've got a much smaller organization than you, of course, Nave, so we know pretty much where the position is going to fit into the structure, and so that's less of an issue. We look at the cash flow requirements, you know, what can we reasonably afford to spend on this role? What are the market expectations around at the moment? Are we going to be needing to revise our budget here or not? And can we do that? So then we will typically place an ad in Seek. And one of the things that I would say, I went through and it was really interesting. I was at a conference the other day and everyone was bagging out Seek as a way of finding candidates. But I've just interviewed, not for a DA role, but for a different role. And I found two of the best candidates I've ever come across. But the key thing with understanding Seek is Seek is an advertisement. And in many ways, because I live in Canberra and, you know, there's a lot of people competing for public service jobs in here. So one of the things that we've had to do is make sure that our ads have very compelling copy on them. And so it is a sales process. And just to be clear about that, it is absolutely a sales process. They're trying to sell you and you're trying to sell them. And so we have been very careful to make sure that our ads are written well and they're not just cobbled together, you know, dental assistant position, apply within. Yeah, it's not like that at all. So that's the first thing, is create a compelling offer. Then what we do is we would then look at the applications that come through. Now, for me, I'm always looking to hire on attitude rather than skill. I can train skill, but I can't train attitude. I would love to have attitude and skill, and sometimes we get that, but sometimes we don't.
Sure.
The other thing that I would say around that is trying not to hire in desperation, because at any given moment, you don't know who's going to walk through your door. So we try and make sure we have understudies in our practice. So if someone does leave and we can't fill the position immediately, we have a bit of a buffer until we can get the right person. So what I do is I like to get applicants to fill out a questionnaire when they come for their interview. And the reason I like them to fill out a questionnaire is I'm mildly interested in the answers, but I'm more interested in their communication ability. So I'm checking things like, can they spell? What's their grammar like? Can they construct a sentence well? All those other sorts of things. Because ultimately, if they're a dental assistant, I'm going to be asking them to potentially write my notes for me, or, you know, I'll obviously sign off on them and peruse them. But if I'm getting them to write my notes before I sign off them, I don't want to have to go back and rewrite them or do a major edit. I want to be able to know that they can competently write a set of notes for me, or put the basics of a referral letter together for me as well. So I do test their ability to communicate. So that's the first thing. The other skills test that we would do for a DA as well would be to mix a bowl of alginate. And again, I'm interested in how well they can mix alginate. But more importantly, I'm interested to see whether they clean up after themselves.
Sure.
So just little things like that give me a bit of a clue as to their awareness of what's going on around them. If you see, you know, the filthy bowl, alginate, and, you know, slumped all over the bench or whatever, then I'm going, okay, well, they haven't really thought about how they want to clean up. And then when we go through the interview, you know, typically, I've got a list of interview questions that I have, but we talk a lot about our practice values. We've gone through a process of articulating the values of our practice. And so I'm asking questions probably like what you've gone through already, Nove, which test for, are we in alignment with our values? I want to be sure that we've got a square peg in a square hole here. And then, you know, what do they want to achieve in their career? How long have they been in dentistry? What do they want to do in the next 5 years? All those sorts of questions. And again, depending on the role, this is a DA role, but if it's a reception or practice manager role, I'm very keen to know particularly about their career aspirations, because typically I find those people are quite ambitious and I want to be able to give them a role that stimulates and challenges them and gives them room to grow as well. That's kind of the process. And then we have a candidate evaluation form, which we use so that we make sure that we keep notes about each application and we're comparing apples with apples. So, you know, as soon as they leave, we'll get together and, you know, write notes about it, about how the interview went and things we liked, things we had questions about. And then if everything's going well, we might get them back for a second interview with the team or a second interview with us to go back through a few more details. And then all things being equal, we select the best applicant and offer them the job after having done due diligence with reference checks, or if they're obviously a dentist or therapist or hygienist, we check their registration and other bits and pieces, and then we make the offer.
Yeah, no, that's excellent insight, Jesse. And, you know, from a personal point of view, I feel as though when it comes to hiring graduates, there's not a lot of people that have a better process than myself. And the results have spoken for themselves in regards to graduate dentists. And that's because I understand what we want out of the graduate dentist really well. I understand, you know, what they go through at uni really well. Speaking, a lot of my friends are still demonstrators or, you know, are in Queensland Health or government organisations that host students. And, you know, it allows us really good insight in that. And that I've been able to create some really good systems around that. But I can see the systems that you've created for auxiliary staff, which is what causes the bulk of the headaches for most practice owners, are phenomenal. You know, this hiring process leaves very little room for error. And, you know, when you minimise staff turnover, when you start to get the right people and have a process that you can trust in, I think it removes a lot of the headache that's associated with ownership, and that's great insight.
Can I dive into your process a little bit for recruiting graduates, because that's something that you've obviously got that down pretty pat. What sort of things would you do differently than the things I've just gone through with recruiting auxiliary staff? What additional things would you have in there?
Yeah, look, I'm going to be honest, Jesse. You know, you talked about how it's a sales, like you're selling your practice your job as the job to go to. That's kind of what I do for dentists, but it's not something I ever thought about doing for a dental assistant or reception or, you know, that kind of an auxiliary role. So, you know, it starts with that for us. You know, we've incorporated technology. We've basically got people like yourself training our auxiliary staff now. So all of that gets sold in the job. You know, and our mentoring program, we've actually got a mentoring program for graduates that they move through, where there's an intense bit of mentoring at the start of it. And then as they go through the first year, we back off a little bit.
Is that formalized, mate?
It is formalized, yeah. So that's formalized to the point, you know, where they need to do certain things on models first, certain number of procedures we want them to be able to do. And then by about the 4 to 6 month mark, we start to ask them if there's anything that they want to look at possibly not doing, and is there anything they want to focus on. And when that happens, when they bring, like, you know, we have a graduate, I should say, she's no longer a graduate, but had a really good ability with surgical extractions and a really strong interest in that. So, yeah. You know, we developed a program around that for her, where she would come in and watch myself. I'd be in the next room when she did her cases. And, you know, we'd have an open line of communication with respect to her sending me OPGs. And basically, you know, she's at the point now, 18 months out of uni, that she can do about 60 to 70% of the wisdom teeth that I can do. And that's huge. You know, like, I've been doing this for many, many years. And for her to get to that point in 18 months, that's quicker than I got there. And
you so, probably didn't you know, have the mentoring.
No, definitely not. I mean, I did, but not, I guess, to this degree. And I think the key thing out of that is I have an inherent belief that if a graduate starts working with our organization, by the end of the first year working for us, they will be as good as they could possibly be in any job. And, you know, when we're hiring the right people with our hiring processes, you know, our interview, like you talked about with the Elginet, you know, we have interview questions where they're actually answering a question that they don't even know that they're answering. And when you can develop questions like that, it basically allows you to get to the bottom of the person that they are versus
the veneer that gets put on for
exactly
the interview.
Exactly right. And, you know, there's clinical questions disguised as staff management questions that, you know, a lot of them go segue straight into the clinical and leave out completely the staff management side of the question. And that, you know, based on all of that stuff, it allows us to get what we feel are the best graduates. And then we have a program to develop them to become better. And, you know, it seems like you've got that for auxiliary staff. So yeah, look, that's great insight. And I think that's going to be great for the listeners to take away.
And just out of curiosity, Nev, because our training for a person coming on board is typically 12 weeks. So we break down all the tasks that we want them to master, and we try and drip feed them over 12 weeks so they don't feel like they're getting smashed in the first, you know, week, basically. Do you have a similar sort of structure with the graduates? Do you, you know, with that, is it like a competency log that you keep, or just I'm curious to get some detail around that.
Yeah, yeah. Look, Jesse, I'm embarrassed to say this, but you know, I'm involved in the recruitment of them, but one of our other dentists actually administers and created that whole program, so I outsourced it to him.
Delegation.
And he's run with it, and he's created a great thing for us. And you know, for myself, I got involved with mentoring this particular graduate because after her period of the general mentoring, she wanted, you know, surgical wisdom teeth were her area, so that's where I got involved. But the specifics of that, like, I know they do some work on models, I know they have some cases that they present to him, but to be honest, I'd have to go and ask him. I don't actually know the specifics around that.
Cool.
And yeah, he administers it for us and basically directs the graduates to a particular dentist. So now we have the advantage of having some specialists on board. So, you know, he's got that up his sleeve as well. So if someone's interested in root canals or implants or perio or anything like that, they can go and speak to the specialist, peds dentist as well. So, you know, it's really good in that way, but the specifics and the nitty gritty of it, I'm not actually quite sure of, to be honest.
Yeah, look, that's completely cool. But one of the things, and just if you're listening to this audio, just want to quickly recap. We're talking about how to transition from survival to stability. We've covered a lot of things. We've covered cash flow forecasting. We've covered, you know, some of the systems around that, you know, whether it's appointment scheduling and how to make the budget come to life through the appointment book. We've spoken about internal communications, and we're talking at the moment around HR and building a great team and understanding that your team is going to be able to help you grow fast. But one of the things I just wanted to, you know, we've gone through a whole lot of these systems and processes, but one of the things I just want to highlight here is you're actually building intellectual property assets for your practice here. And when we came to sell our first practice, one of the reasons that it sold at the time for a good price was because of the intellectual property assets that we'd built into it. So, Nov, do you have a view about intellectual property assets of your particular group of practices?
Yeah, look, I think for myself previously, that hasn't been the case. But when you look at the, you know, I have some intimate insight knowledge into the way the corporates act, the way the corporates think, and what the corporates want in practices that they buy.
Yeah.
You know, I've obviously, you know, I do a lot of help with private dentists that want to buy practices as well. And, you know, to have a practice that's got these systems in place, got structure, have a program where, you know, staff have a growth vision set for them, all of this thing, they are much more valuable than a practice that all of that is haphazard. You know, if someone walking in to buy a bespoke dental in Canberra, your practice versus a random practice that hasn't got any of these systems in place, and even if the numbers were exactly the same and the location was very similar, then it's just common sense that they're going to pay a lot more for a practice that already has that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the goodwill and a lot of that is, it can be replicated quite easily when you've got systems in place. So therefore you would pay more for that goodwill. You'd be willing to take more of a risk.
That's right. Because it mitigates the risk, right? All those
exactly
IP things mitigate risk.
Exactly right. And so, you know, that's part of what we're doing as well. You know, I have a long-term vision for my practices. And part of that is the fact that, you know, we've gotten to a size where, it's unlikely that I'm going to have a private dentist being able to buy the group. And because our practices and their proximity and the way that they're interlinked, you know, one of the exit options for me is a corporate, unless I break it all up. And, you know, although that's a long way away, it's something that I really need to be thinking about, and it's something that I think is key in terms of, you know, people that are even just starting out in practice ownership to have an exit plan in mind in that sort of way. Yeah.
Look, one of the things we talk about in my mentoring group, Nov, is we always have this built to sell mentality, and you know, anything could happen on any given day, and you want to make sure that your practice at any given moment is at its maximum value. And so I agree wholeheartedly with that notion of knowing what the end is before you start. And, you know, it could be that you're going to sit there for 20, 30 years and work, and that's completely cool, but you still need to know what your exit strategy is around that. So, yeah, mate, I love that. That's cool. Start with that at the beginning.
Yeah, look, Jesse, we've covered a lot today. I think have you got anything to sort of add to any of the stuff that we've covered? I know next episode I really want to get into case acceptance, because I know that's something that's quite critical. It has been for our dentists, but also I know that that's something that the listeners have requested that we segue into as well.
Yeah.
So Before we wrap up today, is there anything else that you can think of that can help people progress through these stages?
Look, I think just to bring it back down to some concrete action steps, the first thing is if you've got a practice and you're at that survival stage, you're at that early stage, a couple of key things to focus on. One is get a budget, get a forecast, nail that down. Second thing is to get your HR sort of start building a team, take a systematic approach. I think, you know, Nove's indicated that one of the things he wish he'd done sooner was getting that under control. And I think I would echo that as well. I wish I'd taken action on that sooner as well. One of my key failings in the early years was around HR. And the third thing I'd say around that is making sure that you've got good internal communication and you're allowing yourself some time to think and plan and grow. And also keep focus on your patient flow all the way through, of course, as well. So that would just be, just to tidy that up and tie it in a little bow, that would be my key thoughts. Now, is there anything that you would add to that, mate?
I think we've covered everything quite comprehensively. I'm really happy with how the discussion's gone today, actually, because you know, I've gained a lot just by being part of this, to be honest. And you know, the ability to sort of give back to the community is really quite good. So yeah, no, I've enjoyed it. Look forward to the next one.
It should be fun. And thanks for being gentle with me, mate.
No. You've made my job as an interviewer quite easy, actually.
Good fun. All right, mate. Look, we'll wrap up for this week. Looking forward to catching up with all you guys next week. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have enjoyed the show, head across to iTunes. Leave us some love. We'd love to get a review or a comment on iTunes, or head across to my website and leave us a comment there. I know Nove and I are happy to continue the conversation with you guys. Looking forward to catching up with you next week. So, Nove, we'll talk soon.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Jesse.
Okay, take care, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.